It's only mid-November, but winter is already here, complete with snow and below-freezing temperatures. If you're someone who feels down this time of year, we'll provide some tips on dealing with seasonal affective disorder. Plus, Illinois has gotten better providing money to school districts that need it most, but there are still huge gaps that have to do with how our district borders are drawn. And rural Illinoisans often have to travel farther to get their food. We'll talk with folks from around the state who are trying to bring more fresh and local food options into their communities.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Gwen Maxey. Coming up later this hour, how the way your school district is drawn can make a huge difference when it comes to the funding you get from the state. Plus, what's being done to improve local food options for Illinoisans in rural areas. But first, I hope you enjoyed your short fall, because today we're seeing snow and below freezing temperatures throughout the state. Maybe your local school district is closed. Maybe you were stuck on the 74 yesterday, or worse, stuck at the airport. There have been more than 1,200 flights canceled at O'Hare. Well, the cold weather and the short days can be more than just an inconvenience. For many of us, it can also just be harder to get through the day this time of year. Depending on the situation, there can also be a name for that: seasonal affective disorder. We asked listeners on Facebook to tell us whether they feel a change in mood this time of year, and we got lots of responses. Emily said, quote, "It gets depressing. I like to surround myself with friends and family, find events to attend, and try to find the determination to exercise." For more on this, I'm joined by Dr. John Strax. He's an integrative family physician and an assistant clinical professor of family medicine at Northwestern University. And Dr. Sally Weinstein is also with us. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and an associate professor at UIC. She's also the associate director at the University of Illinois Center for Depression and Resilience. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So glad to have you. And I hope that both of you, got to work this morning, didn't have too tough a time, summoned the energy. You didn't have kids who had school closures. Are you guys both doing okay this morning? Just checking in.
It was a chilly walk to school this morning for sure.
Yeah. These first few days of this kind of weather is so hard. Dr. Weinstein, how often do you hear about weather from patients during these months? Do you see a lot of seasonal affective disorder in your practice?
So I work with children and adolescents with mood disorders. So a lot of times the kids who are coming in to see me already have a diagnosis of depression. We certainly see that the fall and early winter season is a difficult period for our patients, and we have new referrals as well. You know, whether that has to do with other stressors that sort of coincide with this season or the season itself, we definitely see a worsening of mood difficulties right around now.
And how do you define seasonal affective disorder? Because, you know, I would imagine that it's sort of hard to differentiate between that and just what a lot of people go through this time of year, you know, what we used to call the winter blues.
Sure. Seasonal affective disorder is definitely different from the winter blues. It's a form of depression, really meeting all of the same criteria that one would meet for the diagnosis of depression, but it shows a very distinct seasonal pattern, and it's linked to the start and then the stop of kind of the fall and winter season particularly. And to really receive the term seasonal affective disorder, we have to see that pattern at least 2 years in a row.
Oh, okay. And Dr. Strax, do we know if seasonal affective disorder is a result of literal lack of a certain spectrum of light? Because you know, getting outside seems to help everybody feel better. Just breathing some fresh air, moving around, getting out of their own thoughts for a minute. What do we know about the biology of this?
We don't know precisely what causes seasonal affective disorder. We know we see it in somewhere between 5 and 15% of the population all over the Northern Hemisphere. There's some thought that it's related, not necessarily to the spectrum of light, but to the shorter days that happen in the winter. And so as the days get shorter, as people get less exposed to light as the season goes on, we think that that's one of the reasons that people develop the disorder in late fall, early winter in the Northern Hemisphere.
And what do we see in communities where the days are so short, you know, up north, where the days are so long for 24 hours, but then they're also so dark for 24 hours? That must be even worse, I would imagine.
There's, you know, the data has been done, a lot of the research has been done in the United States, Canada, and actually the United Kingdom as well. And so rates seem to be similar in the United States and Canada. I haven't seen it broken down by specifically by latitude. I'm sure there's a fair amount of the disorder the further north you get. Just an interesting tidbit, people in Iceland show less seasonal affective disorder than people from other countries. And the thought is that somehow the genetics of people there protect them from the disorder.
Oh, that is fascinating. That environment can affect genetics. I find that really, really interesting. So to both of you, I'm wondering what the best therapies are for people who have seasonal affective disorder, from the very serious to the milder. What kinds of therapies do you practice? First, let's hear from you, Dr. Weinstein.
Sure. So I practice a form of therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy that really looks at kind of the connection between the way we think about things and how we're behaving and how that influences our mood and kind of the responses from the world around us. And this form of therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, has shown to be very effective for depression, particularly in children and adolescents with whom I work, and would absolutely be kind of among my first line of recommendations for youth who experience a seasonal affective depression, particularly because, as I mentioned, to be considered technical seasonal affective disorder, we see it recurring at least 2 years in a row. So cognitive behavioral therapy would, in theory, give the tools to kind of manage when these blues start up again the next season.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Strax, do you have any general therapies that you try with your patients? Obviously, they have to be individualized.
Absolutely. There are a few, and recommended oftentimes that people use light therapy in the winter in form of a bright light box that people will sit in front of for about half an hour in the morning as they're getting ready for their day, and also what's called dawn simulators, which are lights that gradually turn on in the bedroom as people are waking up in the morning and sort of tricks people's systems into thinking that the days are longer than they actually are. We also frequently will recommend antidepressant medication to people who need that. And I work in an integrative medicine office that I run, and frequently we'll talk with people about vitamins and supplements to use when this happens, and other treatments such as the ones that your listeners use, exercise, getting outside, sleeping well, making sure that they have bright lights around them all the time.
Dr. Weinstein, let's get into some of our listeners' comments, and they were all over the map. A lot of them were a lot of fun. A lot of them were much more serious. We asked people to tell us whether their mood changes during the winter and what they do about it. We had a lot of people chime in on Facebook. Tegan in Champaign said she keeps her calendar full, quote, especially after the holidays when it's easy to end up alone for days on end, home alone. Dr. Weinstein, how big of a problem is loneliness when it can be hard to leave the house? And would you recommend doing what Tegan is talking about here?
I love what Tegan is talking about. I think that sounds great. I think, you know, during the winter in particular, it is harder, whether there are mood difficulties or blues or not, it's harder to motivate to get out of the house, and that can definitely impact our mood subsequently. So I think keeping your calendar packed, maintaining a routine is so important for mood and energy levels. It's something that just happens so much more naturally during the spring and summer months, and something that I think we have to make a little bit more of a directed effort to do in the winter. So I think that's an excellent strategy.
Yeah, and of course, exercise is always a mood lifter. Some listeners said it was really hard to do that. Others said it was a big part of their winter routine, whether it's Skye in Beloit, Wisconsin, who told us that playing in the snow with her kids really helps. Kristen said she bundles up to walk outside, and Craig says he even bikes this time of year, which I find to be interesting. How important is exercise, Dr. Strax?
It's absolutely important. It's one, you know, as Dr. Weinstein was saying, we think of seasonal affective disorder as a subcategory of depression in general. And so exercise is frequently one of the treatments that I'll recommend for depression and for seasonal affective. I think there's some nice studies out there that say people will exercise to the extent that they like the exercise. And I say to my patients frequently, I don't know that many people who love to get on the stair climber every morning. So I think with sense about what it is they really like to do, whether it's walking, dancing, riding your bike during the winter, getting outside and hiking, or playing sports, or whatever it is that really, really excites people, and try to encourage people to do that kind of exercise through the winter.
Of course, that does beg the question. It's a little bit of a chicken and egg. If you're feeling depressed, you don't want to get outside, and getting outside is what will help you feel less depressed.
Absolutely. And there are interesting studies in what's called behavioral activation that a lot of us would assume that as we feel better from depression, we start doing the things that we like to do. And a lot of studies out there that say that if we go ahead and do those things, even if we don't feel like doing them, as we do them, it will pull our mood with it. And so I do recommend that people try to get out and do these things if at all possible.
All right, so I wanted to read another listener comment. We asked people to share how they deal with the winter, and David in Rockford just said vodka. And six people liked that comment. I'm just going to assume that that's not something you guys would recommend.
Not usually.
No, especially like for the kids that I treat, that would not be on my list of recommended solutions.
Well, you know, that brings up another interesting topic, because we were talking about this subject before we got on the air, and we all agreed that, you know, when we're little kids, being in the snow and outside, none of us remember getting sick of it. It was always such an adventure. But then you get to a certain age, and it does start getting, you know, more depressing. It's like, oh, this again. We know it's four more months of this to come. Is there a turning point that you see in your patients, Dr. Weinstein?
You know, I think we sort of see two turning points. We see improvement as we're approaching spring, but then more difficulty towards the end of the year, again, probably more because of some of the kind of environmental stressors that are happening at that time. It's the end of the year. Kids are anxious to end the school year and want to just be done. Teachers are ready to be done as well. And so as the school year kind of drags on towards the summer, we see that being another period of difficulty. But then summer is a time where we see huge improvement in mood and energy and activity level, particularly in kids and adolescents who still have structure in their days. So they're still engaged in activities. They're going to camps or keep the same general structure that they have with school, but much fewer of the demands and obviously an improvement in the weather.
Okay, and this we don't have much time left. Dr. Strax, if you're listening to this, if for our listeners who are listening to this, and you're wondering if seasonal affective disorder may be what you're suffering from, what is the first thing you should do?
I would go ahead and talk to their primary physician. And it's, I think, much better recognized these days that people that seasonal affective disorder is real and is can be quite troublesome for some. And so if your listeners are thinking that really they feel like there's something going on with their mood that they don't like and is troublesome, I would reach out to a primary physician and have a discussion about various options, including medication, but also maybe including the light therapy, different herbs and supplements, and some of the other strategies, such as exercise, that we were talking about. It's real, but it can be treated effectively.
All right. That's all the time we have. We could talk about this for quite a bit longer. That was Dr. John Strax. He's an integrative family physician and an assistant clinical professor of family medicine at Northwestern University. We've also been speaking with Dr. Sally Weinstein, who's a licensed clinical psychologist and an associate professor at UIC. They've been telling us more about seasonal affective disorder. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank Great. You.
Coming up after the break, Illinois is finally providing more money to school districts that need it the most, but it is still not nearly enough. That's in just a minute. I'm Gwen Macsai. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. It's a tale of two cities in education, neighboring school districts that are worlds apart when it comes to funding. Depew Community Unit School District 103 in north central Illinois, about a half an hour west of Starved Rock State Park, is one of the poorest school districts in Illinois, and it's located right next to Putnam Community School District, a considerably wealthier district where the tax base is higher and the district spends thousands more dollars per student every year. It's one of dozens of districts around Illinois where these stark dividing lines exist. Illinois recently changed the way schools are funded to address these inequities. Tier 1 school districts like Depew will be prioritized for state funding, while Tier 3 districts like Putnam will receive a majority of funding from local taxes. But has the new funding formula had an impact, and what will it take to dismantle these dividing lines? I wanted to start by speaking with Juliana Quintana. She graduated as valedictorian from Depew High School last year. She's now a freshman at Lake Forest College in Illinois. Juliana, welcome to The 21st.
Okay, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, good. Juliana, we wanted to just start by talking a little bit about Depew and what the town is like for people who've never been there. Can you describe it a little bit?
It's really a small, inclusive community. You basically grow up with the same people since it's a pre-K through 12th grade school, and you basically watch all your peers grow with you, and you see them develop, and everyone knows each other. In a way, like, that's something I really liked about the school, because, there's no cliques. You don't have to worry about anyone, social status, because, no one's really socially greater than anyone else. We're all, equal in, different ways.
Well, that sounds fabulous, actually, if you don't get too sick of the people that you're going to school with for 12 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's what made us really close to each other. And for events, for example, when we had, homecoming events, we never really had to worry about, being an outcast or being seen as an outsider, because you know everyone and everyone knows who you are.
Well, as we mentioned in the intro, Depew receives significantly less funding than the neighboring district, Putnam. Did you notice any differences between your high school and other high schools in the area?
I was younger, I really did not know much, because you grew up and that's basically all you ever know, all you ever see. but as you grow up and like once I entered high school and you make other friends in like different schools per se when you play sports and you go to their schools. Like we play Putnam County, like when you go to their schools and you even to like their locker rooms or their uniforms and stuff like that, you just like start to like realize, okay, there's some differences going on as well. And I feel like high school is really what changed me, and that's when you start to realize, okay, these schools have like better resources than we do.
And are there things that you feel might help students succeed in DePue or other smaller communities that are missing?
I feel like there's a lot of work to be done in DePue, considering that we don't really have AP courses, foreign languages, or anything that could help us. For example, most of us are Spanish-speaking people, and we could potentially improve our Spanish and do something with it rather than just lose it.
And I know that you spoke with Lee Gaines, the education reporter from the Illinois Newsroom, for her story about some of these districts where there are big gaps in student funding. What was your reaction after you read that story?
In a way, I knew about it. In a way, I did not know. Because I really did not know like how like property taxes work and all that. But like I said, as I grew older, I grew wiser. And I started to be like, okay, per se, houses in DePue are way cheaper than houses in Putnam County. And that's when, like, you realize, okay, schools rely on property taxes, and DePue is a super fun site, which makes it, people don't want to, like, live there. An example I could use is I work back at home, and one of my coworkers was saying, oh, yeah, like, where are you from? And then I said, DePue. And she's like, oh, I was actually going to, like, move there and, like, rent a house. But then I heard all this stuff about how you can't garden, you can't do this there because it's such a bad community. And when that happens, it really in a way does bother me that people don't really realize, like, yeah, we struggle with it, but we make it work.
And how has it affected how you feel about being in college?
In college, I have not met anyone on this campus that has like the same academic background as I do.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, it intimidates me, but then I also have to remind myself, okay, I'm here because I can do it. And I applied to, like, other schools. And once I started getting into different schools, I started to realize, okay, I can do this no matter what my academic background is, as long as I have, like, the will to actually fight for my further education.
Do you feel like you are working any harder than your peers in college, or do you feel like this is just maybe a little bit of an insecurity since you're coming from a different kind of school?
I think it's both, honestly, because like I feel as though I work in an assignment and I don't do well on it. I feel like I'm insecure, like, okay, maybe I'm not good enough to be here. And I question all my education that I had in the past as well.
Mm-hmm. And you have a few younger siblings. And they're growing up in DePue. Do you think that it'll be any better for them?
This is like the main reason why I'm doing like these interviews, because like I really like, they really mean so much to me, and I really do want them to do better, and like the school to improve. Because it makes me sad when like my friends back at home, for example, out of my graduating class, two of us, including myself, went off to a 4-year school, and mostly everyone else thinks, like, oh, there's nothing else you'd like for us. Like, we basically just either you go to this community college or you go into the workforce. They really don't see as much. They don't see their potential in the real world, if that makes sense.
Sure. And how big was your graduating class?
My graduating class was, like, 30 kids. And that was one of the biggest we've had in a while.
Mm-hmm. And just lastly, ideally, what would you like to do with your college degree? What kind of profession are you looking at, and what are you dreaming of down the road?
I feel somewhere along social work field or just communication, and like making people aware of everything going on and like the resources too. Because I feel like also like where I grew up, people don't know the resources available to them or like how being low income can actually help you financially in college and you get a better financial aid.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And I feel like that's really important because most people back at home are like uninformed of all these opportunities, especially since most of us, if not all of us, are first gen, and having to explain to our parents college material rather than them explaining it to us is also difficult, and it's been a challenge for myself and my peers at home.
Juliana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Juliana Quintana, now a freshman at Lake Forest College. To talk more about this, I'm now joined in the studio by Lee Gaines, an education reporter from Illinois Newsroom and Illinois Public Media. She reported on some of the funding discrepancies between neighboring school districts in the state, including Juliana's home district in DePue. Also joining us by phone is Rebecca Sebelia, the CEO of the nonprofit EdBuild, which focuses on addressing inequities in education. EdBuild found nearly 1,000 side-by-side school districts with vastly different resources. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much.
Rebecca, when we talk about inequities that these nearly 1,000 districts around the country that are unequal, according to the EdBuild report, what exactly does that mean?
So first of all, we have to think about what borders in our society do, right? Anytime there's a line that's drawn, what we're essentially saying is, you know, some folks stay in and some folks stay out. And the way that we fund our schools, because so much of our funding for schools comes from property taxes, what that means is that the folks who stay in with the higher tax base get to keep all of their money, and other kids obviously stay out. What we found across those almost 1,000 divisive borders is that there's an average $4,000 difference per student just between neighbors. When you think about what $4,000 would do for a child every year in terms of helping their education, you start to really understand how inequitable this system is.
And Lee, you visited two districts that are right next to each other, DePue and Putnam. Juliana told us a little bit about DePue, but what brought you there in the first place?
So there are about 43 districts in Illinois, or 43 divisive boundaries, I should say, in Illinois that fall into what Rebecca was just talking about. And shockingly, only one of them is in Chicago. A lot of them are spread throughout the state. So I looked at DePue, and what I found fascinating was that about 75% of their revenue comes from the state. So they're getting hardly any money from local property tax dollars. Meanwhile, the neighboring district, Putnam, is getting almost all of its resources from local property tax dollars. So I was really fascinated by the sort of tale of two districts that was going on. And then the story became more and more fascinating, and also more and more depressing in a lot of ways, because DePue is also a Superfund site. There was a zinc smelting facility that horribly polluted the lake that's there, the soil that's there, and there have been efforts to clean it up, but not enough. And so the property values there are just in the gutter. And so that district is really suffering. And the only way that they're even able to operate is the state money that they're getting.
And that's unusual for a district to be 75% funded by the state, right?
That's unusual in terms of what I've seen as an education reporter. It's not unusual in the fact that there are a number of districts like DePue in Illinois that are deeply underfunded according to our school funding formula.
And so that just recently changed. Can you explain about those changes?
So in the simplest terms, essentially what the state did was say, we are going to direct more state investment to the districts that need it the most. So DePue is one of those districts. So DePue is going to get more state money than Putnam County. But as Rebecca might allude to later on, that doesn't mean that Putnam's going to get any less state money than it used to. So essentially, the state is going to try and invest more money into this formula so that gradually districts like DePue will eventually get a little bit more money as time goes on.
Rebecca, do you think that the new Illinois funding system will go far enough to address the inequities?
You know, one of the problems that we see across the country is that it's very politically difficult to actually change where money goes. And it's increasingly and much, much more difficult to actually take money away from areas where money used to be. And so oftentimes what legislatures do and what has happened in Illinois is a put in place a provision called a hold harmless. That's kind of what we refer to nationally. And what that says is, even though our funding formula, we recognize that it was problematic, but we're going to hold every school district constant for what they're currently getting through this problematic funding formula, and we're going to try to fix it with every new dollar that we can get. When you think about how slow state economies actually change, we're talking about, you know, in some states, 40, 50, 60 years before that funding formula actually fixes the problems that it had originally created.
Wow, that is a remarkable set of numbers there. Do either of you feel that optimistic in any way about this new funding system?
Rebecca, I'll let you answer that first.
I mean, look, we are always optimistic whenever a legislature recognizes that there are certain students who need more help. And what we think the Illinois legislature has done is they've said, they've made that recognition, right? And so that's always the first step that we need to take. And there should be optimism around that. I think that what we need to do is we need to start getting aggressive to push the state to make some of these changes happen more rapidly so that folks like Juliana and her brother and sister, her siblings, are actually going to see that change while they're still in school.
Lee, what about you?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because right now on the track that we're on, the state lawmakers are going to invest or have promised to invest $350 million into this formula. At that rate, Juliana's siblings will never go to an equitably funded school district. And I also want to mention here, you know, I do think that the formula has improved things. Schools like DePue are no longer in crisis mode. But at the same time, DePue needs a whole new school building. You know, that's a very old building. They don't have air conditioning. They don't have, you know, computers for every student. There's a lot of basics there that aren't being met. And, you know, they're getting, you know, $500 to $700 more per pupil a year. But that's not going to get them to where they need to be currently.
So do the people that you spoke with for the story feel that those changes, even though they're not as big as they'd like to see, have they made a difference?
Yeah, I mean, again, they're not worried about, you know, keeping the doors of the school open, which I think DePue and a lot of other school districts around the state previously were. And there's also kind of a can-do attitude there. They're like, you know, this is the best that we have. We're going to do the best that we can with it. We alone can't really change our resources. That's not within our power to do. So we're just going to make the best of it. And, you know, you'll have success stories like Juliana's. I think what she worries about is all of the other students that didn't make it to those four-year colleges.
Yeah. Well, this is yet another subject that we could talk about for a very long time. Thank you both for being with us. Lee Gaines, education reporter, Illinois Newsroom, Illinois Public Media, Rebecca Sebelia, CEO of the nonprofit EdBuild. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Coming up after the break, we'll speak with people in central and western Illinois who are trying to bring more local food options to their communities. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. For many Illinois residents in rural and agricultural communities, options for fresh and local food can be limited. Over the past few decades, local grocers have been closing their doors and in some cases replaced by superstores like Walmart and Dollar General. These chains have been able to offer lower prices for less healthy options. Meanwhile, 2.3 million rural households face hunger. That's according to the nonprofit Feeding America. And according to the USDA, millions of rural residents have to travel 10 miles or more to buy their groceries. Today, we thought we'd check in with some of the folks who are working on ways to offer more local, healthy, and fresh options directly to their communities. From Western Illinois University, Sean Park is the program manager for the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs. He's on the line with us now. And joining us from our partner station, NPR Illinois in Springfield, is Molly Gleason. Molly is the communications director for the Illinois Stewardship Alliance. Sean, Molly, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Sean, before we talk about your role with the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what food shopping was like for your family growing up. Did you have a grocery store near you?
Yeah, you know, I've lived my whole life in small towns in Illinois. And, you know, boy, growing up, there were as many as three stores in a small town of 3,000 people. So, yeah, it's a whole different experience. Now you pretty much plan on driving.
And in have you seen it go down in your hometown or just in generally in rural Western Illinois, you've seen a decline in the past few decades of fresh food?
You know, not just in Western Illinois, but in all of Illinois and across the Midwest, we've seen that. And, you know, from my own experience, I ran a small IGA grocery store from 95 to 05. And when I started, we had three stores in town. And we're down to one here in Rushville.
Molly, you work in Springfield, but grew up in Elkhart. That's a small community about 20 miles north of Springfield. And what did you see growing up?
Sure. I grew up on a farm in Elkhart. My family does corn and soybean production, and Elkhart does not have a grocery store. So I never grew up with a grocery store around me. We went to Lincoln, which is about 10 miles or about 15-minute drive from Elkhart. So that's where we always went for our groceries. But we had a garden. You know, we always we grew a lot of our own fruits and vegetables, and then we would just stock up every week when we went to Lincoln. So the first time I actually had real access to a grocery store was when I went to college, and I remember thinking, oh, this is what it's like to not have to buy, you know, like three cans of vegetables and, you know, like a whole pile of meat to put in the freezer all at one time. I could just, you know, run to the store whenever I wanted, which was really nice.
So according to the USDA, you are not alone. About 5 million people in rural areas have had to travel 10 miles or more to buy groceries, which seems like a real hardship, especially A, if you don't have a car, B, if your car breaks down. Have you seen people have workarounds? I mean, yes, in the summer you can grow food, but what about in the winter?
Yeah, I think it's a real problem, especially if you don't have transportation. I mean, my family was very fortunate in that we did have access to transportation, and we had, you know, cars for myself and my sister, and you know, a shared car between us, and then a vehicle for my parents. So we were able to get around. You know, we were able to make it to the grocery store when we needed. But for folks who don't have access to transportation, that is it's a real barrier, and it's a real problem. And it's a problem for people wanting to move to rural communities if they don't have a grocery store and they have, you know, low access to transportation. There's not a real strong reason to move to that community. So I think it's also been, you know, kind of leading to the decline of rural communities that Sean was kind of mentioning earlier.
Mm-hmm. Sean, in the past, you've used the term food swamp as opposed to a phrase like food desert, which we've heard. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, that's kind of where you have access to food, but the food itself isn't necessarily the healthiest option. So quite often what we see in small towns, after they lose their grocery store, they lose access to fresh produce, fresh meat, but they may still have a Dollar General, a Casey's, things like that. So you're kind of limited to what's there if you don't have transportation, as we were just talking about. And, you know, that's hardest on folks that are either don't have access to transportation, maybe for an economic reason, or are elderly and have trouble traveling. So it hits them the hardest. And yeah, the access to the food that they do have isn't the healthiest there.
And when you were running your grocery store for the 10 years that you mentioned, did you see a decline over those 10 years? What was the hardest part about running it?
Well, the hardest part about that, and a lot of grocer spaces all at the same time, there was a consolidation. Our purchasing power got smaller and smaller, but that would have been the time that Walmart went from not selling groceries to being the largest retailer in the country. So everyone was kind of concerned about that. You knew that they were opening up in bigger cities around you, and that was going to take part of it. And I think a lot of owners at the time were too afraid to invest in their businesses. So they still have outdated equipment or couldn't afford to keep up as far as remodeling. So it was kind of a double whammy.
Mm-hmm. And just out of curiosity, I've been to a lot of smaller stores that have both a grocery store and a Walmart. And I'm not sure if the grocery store is on death's door as a result. Have you seen that a lot?
Usually what happens for, you know, we work a lot in towns that might even be 5,000 people or less. So a lot of them don't have a Walmart. So there's an out shopping there where folks drive out. Usually what happens is you have that grocery store owner, and in that industry, the profit margin after all is said and done is about 1%. So there's not a lot. It's a high volume to make any money. And the Walmart takes a good amount of the sales, so they're just barely above breaking even. And quite often what we see is then a Dollar General comes in, and they carry some frozen and dry goods, and it takes just enough of the sales out of it that the local grocer can no longer stay there. And so, you know, that's where you end up with towns that, you know, have just a Dollar General, have a Casey's, but don't have any opportunity to buy fresh meat, fresh produce.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit more about what's being done now. Molly, you played a role in the development of a grocery store in Mount Pulaski, which is about 30 miles northeast of Springfield. That store is set to open in the spring. What was it like to develop that store, and why Mount Pulaski?
It's been really fun, and I have to say my role has been small, and Sean has probably played a much bigger role in helping to develop rural cooperatives in Mount Pulaski and across Illinois. But Mount Pulaski, it's where I went to high school, and so when their grocery store closed about 4 years ago, and so they were shopping around for ideas on how could they feed their community. And one of the farmers, Tom Martin, who was kind of leading this effort, approached me. He knew I worked for Illinois Stewardship Alliance and that we worked with a lot of local farms and had a lot of worked on food system development. So he approached me about being involved and being a part of developing a grocery store there. And I was really excited to be involved in it because it was in my home community and I knew that cooperatives were a thing that happened. You know, bigger communities like Champaign and Bloomington had grocery cooperatives, but it was not something I'd ever seen a small community take on. And so having a small community and one that I was very close to take on that role of saying, hey, we are going to feed our community was really exciting to me. And I've just been very fortunate to be a part of the process and have learned a lot from Sean Park at Illinois Institute of Rural Affairs along the way.
Interesting. So, Sean, you're working in communities of farmers, producers. Have any of them expressed frustration over the fact that they're producing food for everyone else through corn and soy, but at the same time there's a lack of healthy local options available for them and their families? I mean, you know, Illinois has a lot of corn and soybeans, but not a lot of cucumbers and tomatoes.
Yeah, you know, it's and Molly really works really closely with producers in our area. Illinois Stewardship Alliance has a great association with those guys. But yeah, it is kind of ironic. some of them don't quite put it together that that is the situation. You know, we tell them when you go there, they know that they would like to have access to it, but they sometimes the irony of not being able to buy fresh produce in an area where, you know, my whole life we've prided ourselves on growing food and feeding the world. It is kind of ironic to have a food desert in an agricultural county. I use the same talking points when I go to talk to them, but, you know, I often tell them we could throw a tomato out the window here, and the soil's so good out the window here, and 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 out the window here.